Could you just start by saying your name and your affiliation?
So I'm Derek Crook, and a consultant in infectious disease and clinical microbiology in the John Radcliffe Hospital, and then also the professor of microbiology in the Nuffield Department of Medicine.
Okay, thanks very much. And just very briefly, can you give me some kind of account of how you got to be where you are now?
Well, the first step on the journey perhaps was growing up in rural South Africa, and very rural South Africa, and then made my way to medical school in Johannesburg, and then from there went through the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene in London, and then did my specialist training in the United States. And then came to Oxford for a year, 34 years ago.
And what made you pick microbiology as a specialism?
Well, it was more not microbiology so much as medicine. And I trained as a physician, trained as an infectious disease doctor, and had done a lot of general medicine and infectious disease work, but also trained in pathology, so became qualified as what one would call a jobbing microbiologist. But preceding that, I'd done a lot of research in the United States on microbial behaviour, and that was sort of a natural starting point to do what would be referred to as clinical microbiology. And the differentiation between them at many levels is not great, and at other levels is quite substantial. So it's living across the practice of medicine that's infectious disease, but also having an understanding of the scientific basis of the microbes that cause disease.
I mean, the question I've written down is, I'm asking everybody this, if you had to define a single big question that gets you out of bed in the morning, what would it be? But I could rephrase that, I'm not sure if it's the same question or not, as what appeals to you about bugs?
That's sort of an interesting question, because it's really solving problems that gets me out of bed in the morning rather than bugs. Bugs represents one end of a spectrum of troublesome problems that you can entertain yourself with at one level and excite yourself with it at other levels. And the diseases they cause are fascinating in the way that they interact with their hosts and affect hosts at an individual level and at a population level. So it's really probably the interface between medicine and biology and all that that reveals that's appealing and interesting. I like caring for patients, I like solving problems in a lab, I like writing papers. I'm lucky to do a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to the pandemic. Can you remember how you first heard that there was a pandemic in the offing?
Well, I mean, it was just in the media, and it was a reference to it in the media, which was enormously similar to the first SARS outbreak, and it was completely reminiscent of it. So
was that January, or was that before?
It was December.
It was December
2019,
December,
Wuhan. Mm. And I don't know, whether 12, 14 years before there'd been the SARS outbreak that started in the southern provinces of China and Guangdong, and then became prominent in Hong Kong and didn't become a pandemic. Well, this one did.
Mm.
But it was very similar at the beginning.
Yeah. And was there a sort of slow realisation that this was something that was likely to affect us, or did you initially think, oh, that's interesting, there's another SARS happening in the Far East, and not expect it to?
I didn't have very strong expectations one way or another. I mean, SARS, the first SARS epidemic petered out the Zika event was huge in the media, but really didn't add up to
much. That
was
in Brazil.
Well, it was one of the particular foci was in Brazil, but it preceded, you know, it was evident before Brazil. I grew up with Zika in Africa, so you know, big deal. And then there were similar limited outbreaks of other viral illnesses, such as MERS-CoV in the Middle East, and there was obviously a particular outbreak in South Korea. So one was aware of these. So it was only rarely January, February, that you realised that there were going to be problems. I mean, I visited the WHO in late January, and it was just becoming apparent that Italy, the north of Italy, was having a particular problem. And then it pretty rapidly became clear that this was going to spread around the world. And I didn't really feel particularly alarmed about it, because if it was going to do it, it was going to do it, and I'm pretty even-tempered, and looked at it with equanimity rather than a huge massive alarm.
Mm, mm. But did you think this is going to change the way I work or what I work on?
No,
no.
I didn't think it would necessarily change the way that one would work at that stage. But it soon became clear that there was going to be a need for a huge effort and a massive response. And, that's what we've vaguely anticipated one would be involved in.
Mm.
And I've worked in other areas. I worked in parts of what used to be called Zululand in South Africa. I worked on a cholera outbreak. I've worked in other outbreaks. I directed a major part of the Public Health England where we were thinking about these sorts of things. I'm not taken with alarm.
No, I'm not trying to prompt you into alarm. It's just,
But you know what I mean by
yes,
it.
Yes.
I was matter of fact about it, and if it grew into something and it was huge, one would deal with it and become involved.
Mm. So this is just sort of.
By the way, that's always been the case. It wasn't just because this was emerging.
So just to provide background to what we're going to talk about later, can you just outline briefly the natural history of the epidemic as it's evolved from December 2019 till now, in terms of where different variants have appeared around the world and how they've affected case numbers and so on?
Yeah, there's some aspects of it that were pretty predictable, in the sense that if you have a pandemic, it's kind of spread around the world, you knew that it would go in waves. So that was very clear that it would occur in waves.
Is that because of immunity arising and then varying?
People don't really know why waves happen. Flu does it. It's the biology behind it is sort of not that clear. I mean, the 1918 flu epidemic aware waves. It's interesting. Must be a bit of immunity, a bit of the way people behave.
Mm.
Might be season. A lot of variables. So that was all going to be expected in my mind. What one wasn't really prepared for is how the properties of the virus would change. And they have changed, and there's some characteristics that in retrospect are easy to understand, so they would be completely intuitive. But you didn't really expect it was gonna happen, and those changes have to do with how it adapted to the human, which one expected, or other animals, as it did to mink. but how it would become hugely more transmissible. And then a lot of the history of the ingress of pathogens into other species is that it could be more virulent at the beginning and over time adapt to the host and become a lot less virulent. And it's not clear that's happened yet, but one is waiting for that. Immune escape is very well recognized in organisms, so that wasn't really a surprise. The step changes in transmission was a bit of a surprise.
This is with the emergence of new variants?
It's only some.
So you mean the same variant can increase its transmissibility?
Well, what you're hitting on is something that's got to do with lazy terminology. A variant is in some settings a very, very specific term where you get a single alteration in the genetic makeup. But in terms of the way one has used it for the pandemic is actually what the specific word for it would be a lineage. It quite often has a number of mutations on it. And then in respect of transmissibility, it's a causative mutation that occurs. And that can be on lots of different lineages. And therefore, variant is a funny way of describing
it.
You might
be
aware of that, but it's confusing to a lot of people. And the more that the virus recombines with itself, or that you get convergent evolution, that's where the same mutation occurs in very different settings, unlinked settings of the virus because of selection, you rapidly realize that the business end is down to a few specific mutations. And that's been surprising, the extent to which the transmissibility of the virus has been changed by some specific mutations. Or it might be a combination of mutations, and they're very, researchers, not myself, but researchers are very interested in how there might be additive or synergistic effects between the combinations of mutations, but it's certainly mostly down to single mutations that result in these quite profound changes in the behaviour of virus. And some of them are thought to go hand in hand with altering it. Ability of the virus to escape immune protection of the host, which was expected. I mean, that is quite common.
So one thing I should have asked you earlier is, I've got a question here, what methods do you use to explore the question? I know you've been involved in a project called, an umbrella thing called Modernizing Medical Microbiology. So can you just explain for the uninitiated what that involves?
So the collection of people that have come together in this Modernizing Medical Microbiology arose from a large grant that we succeeded in getting, and it's grown organically with independent researchers working very closely together. And
that started a number of years ago.
2008,
yes, that's about what I thought.
Yeah. And the ambition there was to make use of new technologies that were going to bear on on science in general, but in particular on microbial science and human infectious disease science, and that you could look at them holistically rather than as discrete parts of it. And the technologies that are driving that are digital or computational technologies, quite obviously, and very closely linked to that, the tools that enable you to recover the genetic code and in its entirety. And the synthesis of those two means you are able to assemble the code that's generated in little bits to form the whole chromosome or the genetic structure, and then to mine that for information again is highly dependent on really advanced computational processes. It needs really fancy software, very high performance computers. And then if you have that layer of information, how can you link it, and if you're doing medical science, to people?
Yeah. And to do things like tracking infection in hospitals.
Yes, and yeah. Understanding all manner of things, what are the risk factors that account for people developing disease. So you could do all of the same things with human genetic code. And it was more on microbial end, but there's quite a strong piece that's got to do with human genomics, but a huge part that's got to do with large data sets about humans and healthcare systems. You know, why do people with a certain infection get severe illness and some very little illness? And how does that distribute across populations? And to do those very large analyses across large numbers of people and the microbes that they've got, you could only address by having high performance computing again and all this very robust statistical machines. You're going to speak to Sarah Walker. She's become absolutely world leading in that sort of work. And that was really the background thinking about modernizing medical microbiology scheme, is how can you take these new technologies and, as a result of study, generate new information, identify better ways of doing things that may include better diagnostics, and you know, how can you identify ways of recognizing the best ways of preventing the spread of infection, or even recognizing where you have spread of infection, you can have interventions. And we've had a marvelous time, you know, again, holistically looking at the subject.
Can you give me some examples of some of the kinds of infections that you were interested in before COVID came along?
Well, a couple that have been highly illuminating. If you take a disease caused by a germ called Clostridium difficile, we had amongst us, we've got a sense of humour at least. So there was a great political imperative almost, but interest in ascribing the presence of these germs, as it were, and the disease to dirty hospitals. I don't know if you can remember all of that.
I remember it was in the press a lot.
We were sort of kind of unimpressed with that, and set about very deliberately to investigate the organism with that particular question in mind, and did a huge amount of work very carefully and in a systematic way, collecting cases with the germ and all the information about them and the germs themselves, and were able to recover the genetic code by sequencing the microorganisms, and then did combined epidemiological and microbial investigations, the outcome of which was that the evidence for the hospital being dirty and the source of the infection was minute, and it was much more a matter of these organisms ingressing into the hospital environment, probably through other people, And
so people could carry them around and be perfectly well.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
Like 98-99% of the germ's life cycle is in people who don't even know they've got it and would never have a problem with it. Maybe even 99.5% of people. Particularly children. Anyway, another story. And that was sort of entertaining. Not that we opposed the idea of cleaning hospitals, but the idea that the germ represented a marker for a dirty hospital per se. It was a marker for a lot more than that, a huge amount, not all of it entirely pleasing. And then we were able to demonstrate pretty convincingly, maybe better than pretty convincingly, that the whole so-called epidemic had to do with the way that germ had become resistant to an antibiotic called ciprofloxacin, or quinolone antibiotics. And what you had is lineages of Clostridium difficile that acquired this causative gene that made it resistant to quinolones, and then it spread very rapidly through selection, a bit like SARS-CoV-2. There are reasons why there's selection going on in the background. And once quinolone usage went down some 50% in the community amongst general practitioners, these lineages reduced in number and disappeared, and the epidemic disappeared with it. So it had nothing to do with dirty hospitals and had everything to do with overuse of these quinolone antibiotics. So that was sort of entertaining and a counter to various political slogans. We enjoyed that and laughed about it. And then,
but you could never have discovered that without extremely sophisticated computing and DNA sequencing.
And systematic, careful accumulation of information about the patients, which we got from linking clinical record systems in the hospital and getting all the necessary information governance arrangements organized by the hospital. It's a huge effort. All those permissions to do it in a very diligent and safe way in terms of having. And then we've done similar work with TB. With TB, it's got lots of dimensions to it, but one of the most pleasing is that you can take the genetic code and mine the genetic code and find signatures of resistance in the genetic code. Again, causative mutations, there's a theme here. And they can be one amongst 4,400,000 other nucleotides, and that one change turns the organism from susceptible to resistant. And you can very reliably identify those changes and determine purely genomically whether the organism is going to be resistant to an anti-tuberculosis drug or not, and make decisions about whether to use it without doing the really tedious job and the big faff of growing it and growing it in the presence of the drug and figuring out whether it grows more slowly. And we've just completed a huge global project across 27 countries around the world doing this on scale, and just publishing a large number of papers that enable one to make those deterministic predictions from computationally analyzing the genetic code and singling out which drugs that a particular strain will be resistant to and whether they are susceptible to those drugs. And you can make that differentiation with very high degrees of accuracy. And it's transmogrifying how you practice, you know, TB management, and it was very heavily used in assisting the WHO create a catalogue, as they call it, which is just a repository of the information about each one of those changes in the genetic code, so that people can develop tests for those various configurations. And we've really did most of the work towards creating this WHO-endorsed catalogue. We think it could be a lot better, and we're publishing a whole lot of papers to assist in understanding how you would do that.
Mm.
So again, that is big computation, huge systematically collected samples around the world, brought together and analysed. And it's not just medicine, it's scientists of all different sorts, and it's people from all around the world and been able to effectively work together. We had fantastic success working with China, India, the United States, and then many countries in Africa, Asia, South America, Europe.
So just to drag you back to COVID, so you had this tremendous set of tools for interrogating pathogens, infectious disease pathogens.
Yes.
At what point did you decide that you were going to sort of turn some of that firepower on this new infection?
It was different to that.
How did it happen?
Well, Sarah, Tim and I said, you know, this is going to be a ridiculous feeding frenzy. We won't do research. We'll just work to support the general effort.
Right.
And then about February, March, John Bell contacted me. He said, you know, in government, we've got a huge problem because we can't find people to do what would be considered banal, menial, almost menial jobs. We're trying to stand up huge scale testing in the country, and we don't even know whether any of the techniques involved in that testing, just how you swab, what tubes you carry stuff in, how you process through PCR machines, whether any of them meet the standards that means we can roll this out in the country. And then they were starting to market a whole lot of kits to see whether you, just by picking your finger, you had antibodies to the virus, indicating that you had some element of immunity. And there were all manner of people trying to sell governments complete rubbish. And he said, we know this. Can you do stuff to help us set it all up? And we said, sure. We will assist in the effort. So we set up a program of work between here and at Portendown, and our new people from Portendown have worked in Public Health England, that started screening swabs, just standardized swabs, to make sure that they were safe to use and would not affect the testing for virus. And we did, I don't know, 500 swabs that were there.
But just the actual swab, just the stick with the bit of cotton wool on it.
To make sure it works right.
My goodness.
We did hundreds. Because if you think they're going to be manufactured, they were being flown into the country, there were all the supply problems, and you didn't know if you were buying rubbish or things that worked.
Mm.
So we set this up on a massive scale so they could buy with the understanding and knowledge that these met standards that you would say are safe to use and would not alter the performance of tests. That's why it was banal, mindless sort of work, but we set up systems to do it on a huge scale.
Mm.
And then we did the same to do immunity, and I managed to call up friends around the country. We got people that had been infected, we then bled them, we had these banks of sera that we could then test and roll out tests. We developed a huge ELISA test here.
Just explain an ELISA test.
It's a particular way that you measure antibodies. So it was invented many years ago, but it's So an antibody targets something, which you can say is an antigen. If you immobilize an antigen somewhere, you can bring the antibody in solution close to the immobilized antigen target. It binds to the target, and then you have ways of detecting the presence of the antibody on the antigen target, because it binds very tightly. If you wash stuff away, you're only left with the antibody there, and you can get signals for its presence. And you can put this into a whole range of settings. And we did this in little plates. I don't know if any little plates here, but with little microtiter trays, you might have seen them.
But how does that differ from the commercial antibody tests, of which I've done one, because I'm a UK Biobank volunteer?
Finger prick ones, it's a different way of presenting the antigen and operating the test. They're all the same biochemical reaction behind them, but different representations of it. So we've got the national testing for the COVID-19 epidemiological survey run by the Office of National Statistics. I can take you and show that we run through 5,000 to 6,000 samples a day just around the corner here, and test them on machines for the presence of antibodies to different parts of the virus, the spike part, which you might have heard about, the one called the nuclear protein part. And the beginning of the journey to doing that started with being able to do the testing to demonstrate that these various kits that people had made were already almost uniformly hopeless. And on the side, we started to make one that would perform to a hugely improved extent, partly with Yvonne Jones. And now we've got that now fully established as a test with all the regulatory approvals, you know, running, I don't know, 150,000 tests a month.
And is that, can that,
you
that,
see,
that can
Sarah
only be,
will tell you all about
could
it.
Could that only be used in a lab setting, or can that...
No, this is only in a lab setting.
Yeah,
this
in
is
a lab
huge
setting.
Machines running them.
Yes.
You get 6,000 samples coming into the hospital for this is more than the entire pathology services hospital runs a day.
Right.
So you've got this, I'll show it to you. It's like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? And that work was going on very closely to John, working with the government, trying to stand things up. But
at some point in this process, well, it was quite early on, wasn't it? It was early March, when the government suddenly said, we're going to have to stop testing.
So we weren't
doing
the PCR testing. That's quite interesting. That was the huge sort of realization that Public Health England wasn't able to deliver the services that would enable testing, and many of the components of a national response. In fact, I think the organization went through a minor collapse. That's how we got involved. They couldn't process these samples within their management structures. We did it with Porton Downs because we knew some people there, and we set up a system for doing it with them, very able people. But their formal structures that they had for the response malfunctioned early on. And one of the aspects of that was working with the NHS, they weren't able to roll out tests, and that really was a huge interest in setting up these lighthouse labs and mega labs that did it, and it was highly controversial. It wasn't a very straightforward thing, and there was a lot of rancor around it. Like our local hospital was very upset about it, hugely upset about it. But to do it on scale, you had to deliver the reagents and the tools to do it, swabs and all the rest, and you had to stand up the labs themselves, which we didn't really get directly involved in, although we put a huge effort into making sure that the workflows functioned very well, evaluated and tested those and put them onto the right footing. So, and I got to know some of those people very well. as well as setting up things in the hospital, because we had responsibility and a job to do that locally. So this wasn't really research.
No, but it was a COVID response, so it doesn't... It counts. Yeah.
And so all those wonderful things we were doing in the MMM, we had lots of people around, they were enthusiastic. We came to work every day, we worked, you know, a minimum of 10, 12, 14 hours every day, non-stop, through weekends. And
but you say it wasn't research, but there were papers published. I mean, I've seen the paper
published how
rubbish the commercial antibody test was.
One of them. We published more stuff this year. So we drew together all the young researchers that we have, all the old ones as well, everybody, and we built teams. We've worked unbelievably and unrelentingly through this whole process. And then gradually, as we... And then Sarah got recruited to go and run the ONS study as the chief investigator. In fact, she sits next door here. So she lives and breathes here. And then we started to build very substantial research focus around along the lines that we spoke about, and getting back to the genomic kind of research. We are now working on that very intensively as a consequence of a charitable or philanthropic donation from Oracle for 10 years worth of their cloud resources, unlimited, to support genome sequence data assembly, variant calling, the mutations in it, analyses, storage around the world. So
this builds on your scalable pathogen pipeline platform.
And this is now called the genome.
Just talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was a very lovely little innovation that was made out of TB work we did. We built the first very poorly designed, very poorly coded software for taking the sequences of TB, assembling them and identifying other samples of TB that were very closely related. And we could quantify that relationship so that we know that they'd been recently acquired from the person, from one of two people who had it, if you reduced it down to two, or a little cluster that they all acquired it somehow from each other. And that became the sine qua non for identifying outbreaks of TB, and is now nationally, and how you trace those people. You know, test and trace.
Mm-hmm.
And then how you could predict resistance, and out of that work we were able to say, just from the gene code analysis, that you've got a susceptible one, you can use any one of the drugs, safe. No, you've got a resistant one, we'll think about that a bit more, which we can do, and that's a national service. We developed that. It became very clear to us that we had to change the paradigm, and that actually we wouldn't be able to establish the computational resources locally in little mini data centers or computer clusters. We'd have to port the software to the cloud, and it also became very clear that we couldn't design and code up software that reached industry standards. So we started working very hard on trying to understand what you could do better, and hoped that we would eventually have a partner with some tech organization that would aid and assist one in doing this, as you would say, properly. And that has happened as a result of the pandemic. And it was recognized that the code that we'd written that would provide a platform for running the tools could be run in any one of the big global clouds. And that was called SP3. I don't even remember what SP3 stands for.
I just read it out. Scalable Pathogen Pipeline Platform.
Yes, that's what it is. And that was it. that's what it was, you know, the name, it's in the name what
yeah.
it did. And that was recognized as quite an innovative development. The sad thing is that as innovative as it was, it's not scalable because there's so many other attributes that go into designing something like that and coding it that make it scalable, by which you mean you can put it on these cloud technologies and you can run in parallel not just 10, not just 100, but thousands and tens of thousands of these jobs simultaneously and bring them together. So, and that requires coding and platform that enables that. And although this intended to do it, it didn't do it very efficiently.
Right.
It's interesting. Mm. Couldn't foresee that.
Mm.
So the experience with Oracle now, they're relearning that you're going to have to redesign a lot of that, you're going to have to refactor it, and you're going to have to restructure a great deal. And so we had the insights before the pandemic. The pandemic came along, and we can now do the thing that we aim to do much better, massively, massively better than we would have otherwise done.
So what are the questions that you can answer using that particular technology in relation to the pandemic? Or in relation to this virus?
I don't think this is incremental. This is not a massive step change in terms of what you can answer. What it is a step change in is accessibility to it.
Oh, right.
And the
yes.
reduction of cost. And it turns it into an everyday commodity for labs. And
anywhere in the world?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it becomes agnostic. You don't have to have expert people. It's taking the A to Z out of London and put it into a GPS in your car. That's what this is doing. So it's taking what a lot of people loved is having something that you can hold and feel and look at and understand in a sort of disconcerting way, if I could be rude about it, and turn it into something that is digital, is intuitive, and it's touch and point.
So you've got people in Africa, Philippines, everywhere, who are collecting samples and being able to extract DNA.
Yes.
They have to extract the DNA, presumably.
Yeah, there's a lot
of
hard stuff to do. But
yeah.
once they've got a genome sequence, the big challenge was to take the genome sequence, as I've implied already, assemble it. And then once you've assembled it, mine it for the relevant pieces after you've got the complete assembly in place, and then having done that you can analyze it and then test it and demonstrate that it's performing in the way that you would want it to perform against some standard. And we can do that now, so that somebody's got this type of sequence or that type of sequence or this kind of method of preparing it, and upload their information to the cloud, and it comes back with the answers. And that hasn't been possible without having an expert locally to do all of that stuff and work on the command line, the computer, and even write a bit of code to make it work. This is like a GPS. You want to go somewhere, that's how you go there. I've got this DNA sequence, what is it? Here is the answer.
So the Oracle people are doing that work with you?
With group. We're providing, it's a partnership actually.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of things that they do unbelievably better than we can. We'll never do software as well as they can.
Mm.
Although we're establishing a vehicle to address that. They are donating to Oxford to provide the tools that enable you to do those assemblies and analyses. And they will provide the infrastructure in the cloud to process it, and the software that enables you to configure those tools and make them scale so that you can go from running a few at once to tens of thousands at once. So, you know, if you wanted to run a million of these sequences on the tools that are available in most places in the world now to get the answers, might take you a month to run them. The ambition is to have it so you could run them in a day. I don't think they will, but
less than a month anyway.
Much less than a month. And to me that's sort of voodoo stuff, because it needs highly skilled people, of which there are not many that bring that together to make it perform in that sort of way.
So that's the
difference. I don't even get new, more massive insights. You get more rapid turnaround.
Right.
It will be incremental.
Yeah. So, another project of yours, which was, I guess, again to do with speeding things up, is the Lamport study.
How did that
come about?
We worked with Oxford Nanopore.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a fun company. We quarrel with them quite a lot. It's very sweet. Because they've been in
they're a local tech.
Yeah,
they're originally a local tech startup.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
But they're annoying because they're so brilliant, they can do all of this stuff. But they've been quite reasonably not that attentive to detail. But for a lot of these things, you've got to attend to the minute detail. They're getting much better at it now, and they're becoming a really professional outfit, and they have got the tech that is more than likely to become the winning tech. At the moment it's Illumina.
Let's just go back to the beginning again. We have to bear in mind listeners who might not know the background to this. So what does their technology do?
These are the technologies that take the nucleic acids or the DNA or RNA of an organism and then and process that material to generate an output, which is the sequence, which is the genetic code. And there are lots of ways of doing it. At different levels, the different machines you can do it on, and each one of those different machines does it in a very different way, and out of it would come the genetic code. So it's like, if you want, like listening to music, you can have a radio producing it, you can have a tape recorder doing it, you can have a disc,
yes.
And they've all got to have their own way of getting it, but in the end you've got music. And it's a sort of range of devices that sequence, that are quite different, that give you a sequence. And they constrained by various limitations, each one of them, that make it slow or make it difficult to run or expensive to run, exactly the same as audio equipment in a way. And Illumina is the most successful one. So what you might say is that they were like the Sony Walkman that dominated the world, and then another little lot come along and leapfrog over them, which is Apple. Well, in a funny way, Oxford Nanopore is a bit like Apple versus Sony Walkman, which dominates the world at the moment. I think that it's quite possible that Nanopore will leapfrog over, because they've got some really huge advantages in terms of the speed, in terms of the cost it takes to do it, in the sense that it can be tiny and miniaturized. It's small, it's fast, it's cheap.
And what has been your role in the collaboration?
Oh, we've just worked with them a great deal and published a lot of work on Nanopore. So when they came with Lamport, they said, would we be interested? And we were. It's a really neat technology.
So you're testing
and
it essentially.
They stopped doing it. The government was invested in it and withdrew the investment. I have no idea why. It's a story yet to be told, possibly. So it was a very, very, very smart way of doing testing that would be no better than the PCR. It would be faster than doing PCR, but just, and it would integrate into computer infrastructure probably better than PCR. It's actually, funnily enough, a waste of the sequencing technology. So in some ways, as elegant as that solution was, there are more elegant things that Nanopore can do by gathering sequence in a more complete and comprehensive way. I've got a 7 o'clock thing, I mustn't, it's with San Francisco, so I mustn't miss that. So the Lamport was great. We did it very well. We worked with Sheffield doing it, and it got regulatory approval, but it was never rolled out.
Are you still using it in your lab?
No, you wouldn't do that. But you're using the machine. The machine sequencing machines are still there. We're still using them.
Yeah.
We're just about for the UK Health Security Agency in our routine lab, not our research lab, but we're helping the routine lab set up SARS-CoV-2 sequencing. So we're setting that up and we're going to get it going in a standard way in the routine lab, and that will process through this Oracle-related cloud piece, and that's an experiment to establish Nanopore sequencing cloud results to government in hopefully a pretty straightforward, seamless way. So it comes off the sequence, it goes through the cloud in about 15-20 minutes. Currently it takes about 4 to 5 hours to run stuff through, and this has all got to do with having a computer and being able to parallelize things and stuff.
And is that the ONS data that you're running through that, or is that?
We probably will do it. We'll start with smaller scale stuff that's here, but it's likely that the Office of National Statistics samples that have the virus in it will get whole sequenced.
Right.
And we will probably do that. At the moment it's done in Northumbria, and they do it very well. But there'll be the ongoing discussions whether Northumbria should do focus on other stuff, and whether we should do these research related ones here. I think we're pretty neutral. We'll do what needs to be done for that field.